This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Should kids have access to cell phones during school? It will be no smartphones allowed, period, at a private boarding school in Williamstown this year. And schools and districts around the state are experimenting with less extreme approaches after finding the pandemic created even more reliance on phones by students. Is it a good idea? Does it help kids focus better or cut them off from important resources? Let's talk about it. Joining us on the line, John Kalapos. He's the associate head of school for Buxton School in Williamstown. And here in Studio 2, Dr. Neha Sharma, child and adolescent psychiatrist at Tufts Medical Center. John, welcome.
Hello.
And Dr. Sharma, welcome to you too.
Hello.
So, John, explain this year's ban at the Buxton School. How will this work?
Yeah, so essentially, because we're a boarding school, we just ask that students not bring smartphones to school. And no students on campus will have smartphones, and no teachers on campus will have smartphones. You will be allowed to have a non-smartphone phone, you know, like a cell phone from the mid-2000s or a newer device. But yeah, that's the policy.
Don't even bring them to campus. Leave them in your bedroom at home.
Yep.
And this sort of flip phone equivalent, I think it's called a light phone. And what does it allow you to do?
Yeah, it essentially allows you to call, text. You can have one playlist for music. You can listen to podcasts. And it's a really limited device. And yeah.
And why are you doing it, John?
Well, so we all as teachers were sitting around at the beginning of the year and thinking about whether from the 2020-2021 school year, like, how much phones and technology have become like a part of our life, and is that positive or is that negative? And in the classroom, we found that it was harder and harder to keep students' attention, but also out of the classroom, when anyone has a free minute, they're looking at a screen. And so much of education, we feel like, is happening outside of the classroom, in those like in those social interactions that happen between periods or in the lunchroom or things like that. And having smartphones was just diminishing that to a point where we don't want it anymore.
We're talking with John Kalapos from the Buxton School and Dr. Neha Sharma, a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Tufts Medical Center, about cell phones in schools. Turning to you now, Dr. Sharma, a number of schools are claiming that they've seen increased reliance on smartphones as kids return to school after this pandemic isation. A study in JAMA Pediatrics last November bore that out for adolescents, more reliance on all form of screens. Have you seen that in your work?
Absolutely. It's such a painful thing to witness, where kids are so much more reliant on phones. Their sense of self-esteem, self-worth comes from the interactions that are all based on social media through their smartphones, and the inattention is really high. One of the other things that has happened through pandemic is telemedicine. So these are the kids who need some sort of support. And when they're engaging with us in telemedicine, they're actually not engaged at all because it's yet another screen.
And they're tired of screens at the same time that they're using them all the time?
Well, I think what it is that the threshold of what's exciting and engaging has risen so much that to engage kids in person or via another screen, you almost have to be more animated to hold their attention. Kind of like what John is saying, is that inattention has become a real problem here. And I think screens are really contributing to it. So it's impacting patient care on my end, where these kids are struggling just to even engage to receive help. And obviously, it's happening on the education level as well.
So turning back to you, John Kalapos, this idea, you know, I'll use a movie reference, that you have to now dial it up to 11 in order to be able to get a kid to engage. Is that a piece of what you're seeing inside and outside the classroom at your school?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always like to dial it up to 11 in my classroom, right? Like, that's the fun part of teaching. But I also think that it's more of a really dramatic shift that happens in a room, where you can tell that something has just happened online and all the kids went from being engaged to really not being engaged. Mm-hmm. And as a teacher, I have no control over that, right? It's like, oh, so-and-so just posted on Instagram, and then all of a sudden I've lost my class, you know?
Yeah. And so this outside intrusion that gets brought into the classroom that you neither choose nor want as part of your focus of teaching.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, I don't think that it's a great piece of technology to have anyone you've ever met be able to reach you at any time, anywhere, you know, like, but.
So, Dr. Sharma, can kids even process at that level?
I don't think they can, not that well. I think some kids can, but most kids really struggle with it. I think there's a fear of missing out to just have a put a pause on things. I think it's really scary for them. And it's a little bit of a, I guess, a bit of a new culture that if you're not connected all the time, then you're not important.
Interesting. So I want to play a little sound from Kiki Michella. She's the head of school for grades 5-8 at the Elliott K-8 Innovation School in Boston. When we talked with her, we asked her about this mental health piece, and here's what she had to say.
It's really, really hard to parse out on a day-to-day basis what causes what. We just had like a pandemic that we have never experienced before, which impacted students' social-emotional well-being. So I don't know, is it the, like, COVID effect? Is it the cell phone effect? It's hard.
So, Dr. Sharma, that, you know, FOMO, that fear of missing out, could be really anxiety-provoking. You made a reference earlier to self-esteem. What, right now, because I know the research has gone back and forth on this a little bit, mm-hmm. right now, what is the state of our understanding from the research about mental health in kids and screens?
Well, overall, my understanding, it is a little bit bidirectional, that kids who have low self-esteem and don't feel well connected and well understood are a little bit more marginalized, actually do worse on screens, mostly because it becomes their soul. It turns into a dependency, a little bit more addiction, because then it becomes their sole source of entertainment, connection, and feeling a sense of belongingness. But it's all very superficial and all very just based on visuals and optics. So it has a negative impact on them even more than other kids who may not already be having that predisposition. But overall, there's still significant associations of poor sleep for kids who have access to phone all the time. Poor sleep results into poor mood. Not having sufficient amount of rest just neurologically is causes mood changes, and poor mood eventually turns into anxiety and depression. So there is this piece about, on one end, it helps people get connected who are marginalized, but people who also need connections can have a negative impact because it allows a facade of superficial relationship. And on the other hand, it can create like a biological changes, like the circadian rhythm, sleep cycle kind of puts kids into more of a mental health issue and be more at risk.
We're talking about approaches that schools around the Commonwealth are thinking about or may be taking to cell phone use. You just heard Dr. Neha Sharma, who's child and adolescent psychiatrist at Tufts Medical Center. John Kalapos, associate head of school at the Buxton School, where boarding school, where there will be no smartphones this year. Despite everything we just heard Dr. Sharma say, I'm guessing you did not get a chorus of cheers from the students when you said you'll be leaving them home this year.
No. We made the announcement in February, and it was a very unpopular decision. But it's been interesting to see over the course of the spring, we saw students buy in like at larger and larger amounts. And we have a number of students that are excited about it and a number of students that are ambivalent about it, but there's not very many students that still actively hate the idea, you know?
And what about parents? I mean, okay, as a parent of a high school student now, one thinks about all the school shootings. One thinks about, John, times of crisis and emergency where you might want to be able to reach your child. And of course, in your case, the students aren't even living at home. How have parents responded to this?
I think that's like a really legitimate concern, right? And I think a lot of the conversations I've been having with parents are talking them through, what does a smartphone do that a regular cell phone doesn't, right? Like, you're still going to have 24-hour access to your kid. They can still call, they can still text. And there are certain devices that also, like, they have cameras on them. You know, you can video chat. There's devices we've found that allow like a video call with parents, but don't allow posting to Instagram, things like that. And so for me, like, implementing this policy, going through it, I've actually not found things that smartphones do that are critical that another device can't achieve.
So we reached out to our texting club here at Radio Boston about this. We got a lot of responses, and on balance, people were pretty much unanimously on the side of restricting phone use at some level. Cassie in Millis says she's a teacher and says, quote, way too distracting, not necessary at all, though I know many parents and students feel differently since we've seen school shootings, end quote. And then I want to bring in also a voice here, Latonia Monroe Naylor, who's a member of the school committee in Springfield, where they attempted a policy, and she told us the policies they had been using just weren't working that well.
We did have a cell phone policy in place where basically the staff could take the phones for the day or lock them in a safe until the parents could come pick it up kind of thing. But it was just so problematic that it was taking away from a lot of the time that folks are trying to spend teaching and educating kids.
So bear with me, because Dr. Sharma, I'm going to turn to you, but I also want to play a little more of the tape from Kiki Moshella, who's the head of school at the Elliott 5-8. Since last school year, her school has been using this pouch from a company called Yonder, and it does have a relationship with some schools, that students put their phone into at the beginning of the day, and they keep the pouch with them, and it's used to help with distractions.
Students feel the level of empowerment that their cell phone is still on them, like in their bag or in their pocket. So they don't have that problem where they have to like put it in this plastic bin and leave it here. Cause you know, nobody really wants to leave their cell phone anywhere. but they're not tempted to use it, whether it's in class or go to the bathroom or anything like that.
And sorry, Elliot's the K-8. Dr. Sharma, I'm holding my phone to my chest right now. It's here in the studio with me because it's become symbolic of so much more. How do we help families let go, and should we be?
I think setting limits is a really important thing. What I heard from John, that when the policy is made and announced like overarchingly for the whole school, over time, kids have accepted it. And I think that's kind of what happens, is that people need a reason and permission to let go. But there has to be an overall initiative. So what I suggest to families, that it's not so much of a loss, but a richness. And what really needs to be thought about is, what are you going to replace all the time that is spent on the phone? I think our dependency to have entertainment at any given point is actually problematic, because it takes away from creativity. You must have boredom in order to be creative. And so it impacts natural growth. I have two kids. They're a preschooler and a toddler. Most people are surprised that to this day, I have a 4.5-year-old. I do not have screen at my home. And it's not that I don't watch TV or anything, but yeah, my TV only starts after 10 p.m. Mm. And that has helped me kind of really hold on to the idea that I'm really supporting my kids to have creative. And they're super creative. I mean, problematic at home because of what they use to play. But at the same time, they're doing a lot more pretend play that I don't see other kids do. And it's hard because I have to engage them all the time. But I feel like it has allowed for closer connection, because I am a full-time mom. I'm working all the time. So, and my husband's full-time as well. So it allows for a closer connection. And it's the same thing for teenagers. Teenagers and toddlers are actually not that far apart from each other.
Dun, dun, dun. Somebody's not going to like that.
I'm sure. But they actually need that level of environmental limit setting. And what the parents will be getting is richness of the relationship.
So before we let this go, I'll turn back to you, John Kelepos, one more time. You know, a key to acceptance among the youth and adults, as I've heard from you, is the idea that there's this other option, this light phone. And those aren't cheap. You're a private boarding school. Are there equity issues to take into account, both in the policy there at the Buxton School, but also how other schools might want to or need to approach this over time? How do you think about that?
Yeah. So we are lucky enough to partner with Light Phone, where we'll be providing a cell phone, like a Light Phone, and service to any family and any kid and any staff that wants it. In terms of access, everyone has access to a Light Phone. And if they choose not to use a Light Phone, they can use another device. And that's also fine, as long as it's not a smart device. I also think that in the grand scheme of education and ed tech, the cost of a flip phone is so marginal to the other costs we have on education that this might not be the right policy for every school, but you know, $100 doesn't seem, has never been to me like $100 per student a limiting factor in creating policy. You know, like, I don't know how much money went out during COVID, but there's a, like, it's not a terribly like arduous budget line item for us.
All right, that is John Kalapos. He's the associate head of school for Buxton School in Williamstown, Massachusetts, where there will be no smartphones this coming year. Also here in Studio 2, Dr. Neha Sharma, who's a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Indictments of three men announced in the prison beating death of James Whitey Bulger, the Boston mob boss, who was killed almost 4 years ago.
The 89-year-old was the leader of a South Boston gang who evaded police for 16 years before his capture in 2011.
NBC and CNN there, and indictments have indeed come down for three men suspected of killing Bulger in 2018, just hours after he was moved to a federal prison in West Virginia. A detention hearing this week for one of them, Sean McKinnon, revealed evidence that the murderers knew in advance Bulger was coming. Today, we pull from the Radio Boston archive from the day news broke of Bulger's murder. First up, this reporting from then WBUR senior correspondent David Bueri, who had tracked Bulger's story for years and wrote Bulger on Trial, Boston's Most Notorious Gangster, and the Pursuit of Justice.
He was one of the most feared men in the history of Boston.
When Jim Bulger decided to kill somebody, he killed them. There was no change in his mind. And people knew it.
Kevin Weeks had seen his boss at work, buried some of the victims, and testified at Bulger's trial.
People didn't want to meet him. And people would do what was asked of them without even meeting him because they didn't want to meet him.
He rose from the projects of Southie, along with his brother William, whose parallel path to power went to politics and the presidency of the state Senate, and later the University of Massachusetts. From boosting goods from the backs of trucks, Whitey Bulger graduated to bank robbery in a stint in federal prison, including Alcatraz, of which he was a proud alumnus. Back on the streets, he joined an Irish gang called Winter Hill and killed as a favor for the mafia.
Because of his viciousness and his utter ruthlessness, he became a legend in Boston,
says former TV reporter Ron Golubin.
It was almost like a ghost, a ghostly presence. Even the cops were afraid of him.
He was cunning, disciplined, and low profile. But Bulger's rise from gangster to godfather was enabled and empowered by the government's war on organized crime, in which the enemy was the mafia, the Italian-American gangsters, and not the Irish-Americans. What Boston Mafia boss Gennaro Angiulo and his lieutenants did not know about their outside hitmen was this. Bulger and his partner Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy had been recruited as secret FBI informants.
Isn't that the supreme irony? Whitey Bulger, New England's most notorious mobster ever, is a rat, and the whole time he's becoming more and more powerful with the help and aid of the FBI.
Credited inside the Justice Department with helping take out the top and middle tier of the local mafia, Bulger and Flemmy turned the Bureau into the Bulger Bureau of Investigations.
They came to him to use him as an informant, and he ended up using them as his informant and stuff. He flipped the switch.
Bulger corrupted his FBI handler, John Connolly, who grew up in the same Southie housing project. He corrupted Connolly's supervisor, John Morris. With cash, gifts, and master manipulation, Bulger compromised a number of agents who wined and dined him in their homes and in his. From them, Bulger gained intelligence about rival gangsters and surveillance operations in which he was the target. One agent gave Bulger 40 pounds of plastic explosive, according to testimony at trial. Bulger was even given the identity of people informing about him, whom he then murdered.
There are no words to describe how horrible an act that is,
observed a retired state superior court judge, Robert Barton.
There's nothing lower, there's nothing worse.
From the time he went onto the books as an FBI informant in 1975, Bulger commanded fear across the city without incurring so much as a misdemeanor until 1995. A team of state police detectives, a DEA agent, and a couple of federal prosecutors finally built a case against Bulger and overcame the entrenched opposition of the FBI. But Bulger was tipped off to his coming indictment. The heads up came from John Connolly, the star FBI agent. Off went Bulger with his longtime girlfriend, Teresa Stanley. But he soon brought her home and picked up his other girlfriend, Catherine Gregg.
The fact that he is still a fugitive after so many years is an embarrassment to every law enforcement officer that we work with.
Acknowledged one FBI supervisor, James Burkett, when Bulger had only been a fugitive for 5 years. Afterward, the local bureau tried to retract his statement. Bulger went uncaptured for 16 years. Posters of America's 10 Most Wanted pictured Bulger alongside Osama bin Laden.
This is an announcement by the FBI. Have you seen this woman? The FBI is offering $100,000 for tips leading to Catherine Grieg's whereabouts.
The astonishing break came in June 2011, after the Bureau released a public service announcement focusing on the blonde companion who was 20 years younger than Bulger. In short order, they were both captured in a rent-controlled apartment in Santa Monica. Bulger came back to a city different from the one he'd left. His brother John had done a stint in prison for lying to a grand jury when asked about Whitey. And his brother William had been forced out of office as university president after being subpoenaed to a congressional hearing and deliberately questioned in public in regard to his whereabouts.
On advice of counsel, I am unable to answer any questions today.
After he asserted his Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself, William Bulger was then given immunity and forced to answer questions in a subsequent hearing in Washington in the summer of 2003. Reacting to his assertions of failed memory and apparent evasions, congressmen accused William Bulger of lying. It did not help his cause that a leaked grand jury transcript quoted him as saying he hoped his brother would never be captured. When James Bulger was put on trial in 2013, William Bulger never appeared.
There is an incredible wreckage feel that stretches from the 70s to this day,
says Ron Golubin, the former TV reporter. Though Bulger was convicted of all but one count at his trial, victims expressed frustration that those who had empowered and enabled Bulger were not held to account. The father of Tommy Donahue was gunned down by Whitey Bulger as he gave a ride home to someone who was talking to the FBI.
You know, how Whitey was able to terror everybody for 30 years, murder, manipulate, extort, and not get in trouble at all. Why the government or the FBI sat back and didn't do a damn thing about it.
It was a wreckage field that was deep and wide. And though Bulger may have been the executioner, it had started with a secret special relationship with the Justice Department. Congressman Dan Burton summarized the findings of a congressional investigation into the scandal this way.
Rogue members of the FBI, up to the highest levels, protected informants at the expense of innocent people. Informants committed murders with impunity. Killers were tipped off so that they could flee before being arrested.
Kevin Weeks might add this epitaph, recalling that over a span of 20 years, Whitey Bulger could wake up every day, look out his window onto Boston, and say to himself, I own this town.
That was author and former WBUR senior correspondent David Boeri. We're dipping into the Radio Boston archives from the day Whitey Bulger died, as indictments have been made in his murder. Next, we turn to a discussion that day between host Maria Garcia, then of WBUR, and Dick Lehr, journalist and author of New York Times bestseller Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and a Devil's Deal, which became a major motion picture.
Dick, what's your immediate reaction to the news today?
Well, surprise. Obviously, it's a sudden death and seems to be a violent one. but it's, you know, it was the kind of story that you expected to come one day or another, given his age and his health conditions and his track record as a killer.
You know, Bilger was one of the most feared men in Boston. He had avoided prison for decades, but was convicted in 2013 of participating in those 11 murders, and he was serving two consecutive life sentences. Dick, remind our listeners of the horrific crimes he was convicted of.
Well, he was convicted of just about everything imaginable, from the murders that you mentioned to shakedowns and extortion and loan sharking, drug trafficking, again, the whole range of criminal activity. But the thing that I think that, you know, everyone has to remember was that Whitey Bulger, you know, obviously lived a very long life in a career where longevity is not usually that typical. And part of it was that he was a protective informant for the Boston Bureau of the FBI for a couple of decades.
Yeah, so not only was he an informant, but he was in part protected, also edified by the FBI. Tell us about that relationship.
Well, absolutely. And it was the late 1980s when the Globe Spotlight team, of which I was a member, you know, reported and disclosed for the first time this, what became known as the Unholy Alliance between the crime boss, Whitey Bulger, and the Boston FBI agents, where over time, you know, initially the FBI had enlisted Bulger to give him criminal information, mainly about the mafia. But over time, Bulger turned the tables, and he transformed the organized crime unit in the Boston office into, in effect, an extension of his own gang, where they were tipping him off to investigations, to other underworld figures who were informing against him. And that led to some of those informants' deaths. So it's really a horrifying chapter in the FBI's history, given that it didn't involve a single moment or a single case, but had become a way of life.
I want to talk a little bit about the narrative that he formed throughout his life. He was so purposeful about creating this myth around him, this aura about him. He was so aware that he needed to be liked to be successful. Can you elaborate on that part of him?
Well, there was the Whitey cult, so to speak, because in his gang, as powerful as it was, he never cultivated any successors or anything like that. It was always all about him. He was at the center of it all. And he could be persuasive, charming, pretend. It was almost, he had a politician's touch. He would make you think he cared about you, but he didn't. He just cared about himself. And the moment you did something to cross him, you better watch out. And you know, that's really how, you know, he carried himself throughout.
I think that sort of dichotomy is what has created this sort of lore around him as well. This image that he created where, you know, he was the guy who helped senior citizens carry their groceries into their home. He was the guy who cried when a puppy died, but also the man who murdered people viciously. And that sort of duality has created this myth around him.
Right. Now, he was, I think most people would agree, a classic psychopath who was a narcissistic and ultimately cared just about himself. And those gestures he made that you just mentioned that seemed helpful and genuine were really self-serving to the fullest. I mean, he was creating a zone of comfort and protection in his immediate world where people would think well of him. And myths grew up around him, for example, and they were cultivated by his corrupt handlers at the FBI, that, you know, the biggest one being that he kept drugs out of Southie. Well, the truth is completely opposite. I mean, he was getting a cut of all the drugs that were moving through Southie. So, you know, that's the kind of evil that was in play here.
So he was on the run for 16 years, and his brother was Senate president here in Massachusetts. Now, as you were mentioning, this is a stain on the FBI and the city, and it's easy to think that this was a Boston bygone, but how deep did it all go? And tell us again, elaborate for us, what the city was like then.
Well, yeah, I mean, he became the most powerful criminal in the city from the mid-70s on with the help of a handful of agents in the Boston office of the FBI. You know, it was like the city was theirs. You had the star agent named John Conley, who's in prison today, who had recruited him and was his so-called handler. and the city was their oyster.
Now, you've reported on and spoken with families impacted by Bulger and his crime organization. Tell us again, who were some of these victims, and did their families really feel a sense of justice after his conviction in 2013?
Well, I don't know. You'd have to ask the families. As far as for some of them, they never knew what happened to their relative, their father or their brother, because of Bulger would bury them along the Neponset River, and their bodies remained undiscovered until one of Whitey's henchmen, Kevin Weeks, showed them where the bodies were buried. I think it was a big moment, of course, because he was a fugitive for so many years. I think 2011 was, you know, the big moment when Whitey was finally captured in Santa Monica, where he'd been, you know, living under the radar. And then, you know, obviously bringing him back to Boston and the trial in 2013, another big moment. But, you know, I can't speak for someone who's lost a father to his violence, is, you know, whether now with the death of Bulger, it brings final peace. I just don't know.
What came of those connections between Bulger and the FBI? Did anything change for the FBI? Did the culture of the FBI change after Bulger?
We hope so. You know, following the scandal, which was the worst informant scandal in the Bureau's history, and there were congressional hearings and there were federal court hearings in the late 90s here in Boston. Certain reforms to better monitor an informant relationship between an agent and a criminal were implemented. But it all comes down to the people on the ground and the supervisors. You know, no, it doesn't matter how good it reads on paper, the checks and balances. It's the execution.
Mm-hmm. In your view, did Bulger? Do you think he created a narrative around Boston? Do you think he?
I mean, during his lifetime.
Yeah, during his lifetime.
Well, you know, for the longest time, I'm not sure, because I think it was Boston. He was always just a local, killer and gangster and crime boss. It was only, I think, after the FBI piece. It's the FBI that's a national organization. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways, when that scandal broke, that elevated Whitey. I mean, that's where, we wrote a biography that's a sequel to Black Mask called America's Most Notorious Crime Boss. And the reason why is, you know, the FBI in some ways elevated it to historic proportions, because pick your crime boss, Al Capone, John Gotti, John Dillinger, they're all infamous and notorious in their own ways, but none of them did what Whitey did. And that's bringing the FBI to its knees.
Do you think this brings some closure to this chapter of Boston's history, or do you think it reminds us of the wounds but doesn't really heal anything?
Well, I think it does both. Obviously, we're talking, it reminds us of who Bulger is and the incalculable harm he caused to not just families of his victims, but also to the city at large and especially to law enforcement. And it's something, you know, that's not something we should ever forget going forward. But, you know, okay, there is closure here. He's dead now.
Dick Lehr is the author of Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and A Devil's Deal, talking with Radio Boston host Maria Garcia on October 30th, 2018, the day Whitey Bulger was murdered. We're going to take a step back now. August 11th and 12th, 2017, the world turns its eyes to Charlottesville, Virginia. And just a warning, some sounds and content in this conversation may be upsetting for some of our listeners.
Virginia's governor declared a state of emergency in Charlottesville today as white nationalists clashed in the streets with counter-protesters. Groups including the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis came from across the country to rally against plans to remove a Confederate statue from a park.
The streets are calm at this very moment, but behind me, police are still working the scene here where the fatal accident occurred. Witnesses saying that this driver came plowing into a crowd of counter-protesters. People went flying in every direction. We had at least one fatality here.
Our message is plain and simple. Go home. You are not wanted in this great commonwealth. Shame on you.
So the news reporting there is from NBC, CBS, and PBS. And then at the end, we heard Governor Terry McAuliffe. Kara McClurkin, director of preservation services at the University of Virginia Library, was one of the people watching that day's news unfold in her hometown. And it stirred something. And as an archivist, she thought it was time to act. And since then, she has been teaching and working with other archivists on how to document in times of crisis. She and others will present lessons this week here in Boston at the annual meeting of the Society for American Archivists. Kara McClurkin joins us here in the studio along with Marta Crilly, who is the archivist for reference and outreach at the Boston City Archives. Marta led the archiving effort after the Boston Marathon bombing. Kara, welcome.
Thank you.
And Marta, welcome to you too.
Thank you for having us.
So Kara, I'm going to start with you. Does it still stir you to hear sounds like what we played?
It does. It was really hard to hear, actually.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. And it in that day, how did you make the connection between what you do and what was unfolding in your community?
Well, I'm a history major as my undergraduate training, and it was important to me and to our community to document the stories of what was happening in our community told by the community members. There was lots of things being said about us and about our community, and it was really important for us to provide a mechanism for the members of our community to share their stories, because each one of them was individual. Each of us had a very individual response to that day. And so at UVA, we decided that it was really important to provide an opportunity for community members to share their stories and not have the national news be the only stories being told.
So take us back to that day for just a minute, Kara. And I'm imagining you're thinking, okay, I've got to pull that thread and save it, and I've got to pull that thread and save it. What were some of the things as events were unfolding, specific examples where you were like, we need to make sure we hold that?
So our digital preservation librarians started working on looking at the tweets that was happening, hashtag Charlottesville, not just hashtag Charlottesville, but misspellings of Charlottesville. Some people didn't realize they get Charlotte and Charlottesville mixed up. So like trying to think about all the different ways that people were talking about what was happening in our community. And so trying to capture those things, because those things don't last forever. If you're trying to capture under a specific hashtag, it actually, you only have a few weeks until you lose access to all of that data. So certainly the social media stuff was something we were thinking about. But in the days after, there were physical artifacts left behind. On grounds, there were tiki torches and accelerants, mm-hmm. and people were bringing those things to us, and they were still dangerous. You know, there was accelerant in there, and so the conservators were having to look at them to stabilize them so that they could be safely stored. Again, trying to think about all the different perspectives. We had folks from all over, community members in various ways responding and trying to collect everybody's story.
So I'm going to bring Marta in now, and Boston is no stranger to times of crisis. Marta, recently, that meant, among other things, the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. A little sound on that.
Just before 2:50 p.m., this is the viewpoint seen by many of the 26,000 marathon runners who are approaching the finish line. The first of the two explosions rocks the sidewalk along the course. White smoke blasting into the air, blowing metal barricades into the street, spewing shrapnel into crowds gathered at the finish.
We're gonna need more ambulance there. We need more ambulance.
Boston is a tough and resilient town. So are its people. I'm supremely confident that Bostonians will pull together, take care of each other, and move forward as one proud city. And as they do, the American people will be with them every single step of the way.
That reporting there on the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing from CNN. And then, of course, we heard former President Barack Obama. We are having a conversation about archiving in times of crisis. We've just heard from Kara McClurkin of Virginia about the Unite the Right rally. Now I turn to Marta Crilly. You had a similar experience to Kara's. Is it still hard for you to hear those sounds? And which of the things you later archived pop forward in your mind when we go back to that moment?
It is hard to hear those sounds. Like Kara, this was very much a part of my personal experience. I had been at the finish line a few hours before the bombs went off, and I have strong memories of frantically trying to find out if my friends were safe and well.
But when I think about the things that we preserved that stand out to me the most, I would say that the strong international flavor of the marathon and the outpourings of support from around the world are the things that stick out. The marathon is such an international event. It's very local, but it's also very international. And those were some of the really interesting and wonderful things that were left at the Marathon Memorial.
Give us some examples, Marta.
We had signs from runners around the world, things that people came from around the world to leave things at the Marathon Memorial site. And then people also mailed things from around the world. And a lot of the things that they left were items associated with running. A lot of people had raised money to send to Boston, and they sent in their marathon running T-shirts, running bibs as a signal of that support.
And do you just keep it all? Do you just keep it all?
That is a very fraught question in the archives world. So we did keep almost everything that was at the Marathon Memorial site. Some things are impossible for us to keep because they had deteriorated since they spent several months outside.
Like
so, for example, stuffed animals that had been out in the elements had mold, had things growing on them. Some of those things had to be discarded. But what we did do was we documented with photographs the memorial site so people could see what that looked like when it was there.
And Kara McClurkin, the University of Virginia Library, same thing with Charlottesville?
Certainly what resonated with me was telling the stories from all over, people bringing messages of support. Absolutely. Those were some of my favorite things. You asked about what were the first things we gathered. Some of them were, you know, we talked about the tweets, we talked about the physical artifacts, but those messages of support from other communities was really, or even from our, you know, children. I was looking at some of the materials the other day, and it was very heartwarming and uplifting. There is a street where the car crash happened, and there is other groups in our community who have documented the items that were left in that space. That's something not that the university has done, but it was an effort by local community members. And that's one of the interesting things about when there are crises and tragedies in our communities is that you have different groups who mm-hmm. are collecting and documenting and communicating. And one of the things we realized is that not everybody knows how to do that, including those of us who are professionals. And so looking for ways that we can provide resources to folks who are trying to learn how to document those things that maybe are ephemeral or those things that are online and go away is one of the things that the lessons that I think the cultural community has learned over the past few years is that we really need to provide resources for the community.
We're talking with Kara McClurkin of the University of Virginia Library and Marta Crilly, who's archivist for reference and outreach at the Boston City Archives. This week, the Society of American Archivists is meeting here in Boston, and it turns out there is a role in community crisis for archiving, and we're exploring that here. I'm going to be honest with the two of you. The sounds are usually hard. They weren't that hard for me to rehear these montages today, but hearing you talk about the items and the community stories really, Marta, comes home mm-hmm. again. And I want to use that to talk about why it's so important to do this preservation. I'm pretty sure that 99.9% of people who experienced either of those tragedies wasn't thinking, quick, where are the archivists, right? Except that it turns out this is quite important, Marta.
Absolutely. It's very important to document these historical moments, even though it is very difficult. And this is something that I think the task force that Kara is working with is really going to help with, because we have to be careful about how we do this. At the beginning of COVID, you know, we're the archives for City Hall. We started thinking about how can we document this crisis. And so we put together a way for city officials and employees who were on the front lines to submit their memories and experiences to us. And people were initially enthusiastic, and then we collected nothing, which really puzzled us and felt like a failure. But what we realized was people who are on the front lines are really involved in mitigating the crisis, and any spare bandwidth they have is going towards caring for loved ones and processing their grief. And so we had to pivot and think about ways that we could document this historical moment without putting a burden on the people who were impacted the most. And I think that that is something that this SAA task force can really help with, providing those resources to professionals, but also to communities of people who may not be professionals, but who are very involved in and are creating memory in their communities of these events.
So, Kara, what do you teach communities about how they can help the people on the front lines gather what's going to be most important to preserve?
So I think we do it in two ways. I think we can talk to people about the proactive things that they can do, thinking about how they might collect not just negative things. We're talking here about tragedies and crises and disasters, but there's also positive things, you know, anniversaries in your community and important, you know, retirements of important key figures, and thinking about, you know, who are the people who you want to talk to, who are the community connections you need to make, what do you need to think about in terms of the technologies that you might need to do this work, or the storage that you might need to collect these materials? How do you make sure that you reach all of the people, recognizing that actually it is not our job or our responsibility to force someone to share their memories, right? That is not, that's an individual decision. But to provide opportunities for those who feel compelled or who might find it healing or who might want to share their stories, reaching out to other folks in the community, thinking about the tools that you might need. There are tools that collect websites, for example, or there are best practices for collecting materials so that you can best share them with the world in a way that's respectful to all the people involved. And then to really think about how you would go about doing this in a time of crisis. How do you do this when you don't have any bandwidth? Mm-hmm. And if you can't do it in, you know, day one, yes, there may be things you lose, but things are still there. There are other things that are going to be there over time, people's reflections, people's memories, and making sure that you have the resources when people are at a point where they're willing to share them. And so that's what the Crisis, Disaster, and Tragedy Response Working Group is really working on. We have a toolkit, an online toolkit that anyone can use. Yes, professional archivists, but also community members or community organizations can go there. It's got some templates. It's got some best practices, things to think about. And then we also actually provide a referral service that people can send an email to us, and we will get back to them and help them work through what their issues are.
All right. That is Kara McClurkin, Director of Preservation Services at the University of Virginia Library. Also with us, Marta Crilly, who's the archivist for reference and outreach at the Boston City Archives. This was fascinating. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tocci and Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for joining us today. How about you do it again tomorrow for more Radio Boston?